Welcome to the Everyday Novelist 2020 NaNoWriMo Write-Through, Day 10. I am your host, J. Daniel Sawyer, and this is your other host,
Kitty Nickian.
We are joined today by our fantastic panel of writers of all skill levels. We have...
Tori.
Alexis.
And Gail. Hi, everybody.
Hello.
Oh. I was just really, enthralled by your introduction, Kitty.
Me too. That was great.
Wow. I don't know how to top that.
Bring in the epicness. Beautiful thing. Oh, who wants to start out today? Should we just go around the room like we usually do? Tori, how was your day today?
Okay, so I did, I don't know the exact words because then I started crying from some sad video, but I did around 900, I would say 958 words. I feel like that's good.
Okay.
Not for
149. So you're at, 4249.
I think I'm doing,
okay. A lot better, but also, yes, we will talk about this later, but yes.
Okay. So you are at a total of 4249 for 950 words today. Kitty, how did you do?
Not too bad. Total word count is 2,292.
For a total today of 448. That is your best word count so far.
Oh, yay!
And actually, Tori, that was your best word count so far by 30 words. So,
wow.
Milestones.
Cool.
How about you, Alexis? How'd you do today on your word count?
So, my total word count now is 3,278. I actually wrote 500-something words, but it's going to show
505.
That.
Nice. 505 words. That is your second best day ever. So, very cool. You had one day that was 1,329 a few days ago.
Huh.
You really did.
Block that out of the memory. No more.
That's anti-success
weird.
Bias going on.
Behind a few hundred words.
You had a couple 0 days, and then you had a really good day, and then you had an okay day yesterday and a better day today.
Mm. Good job.
How about you, Gail? What's your word count today?
61036.
Hey, 2,379. That's your second best of the challenge so far.
Nice. Oh, yeah. It's combined with last night, though, right? Because I didn't do as good yesterday
well,
as I did some.
That's what I'm... You know, yeah. It's combined with... it's between the meetings. That's our...
Yes, day. Exactly.
So, and I am up to 21,627 for a daily total today of 2,991.
Yeah.
So that felt pretty good. And I left it in the middle of a scene that I know where it's going, so when we get off, I can go down and get started on tomorrow's words.
Cool. That's awesome.
So, Tori, you seem to have a story about your story.
Well, I think I've hit the point where y'all seem very excited about certain scenes and things like that, because last night I decided to go back home, take a couple of notes, and then I just started writing out a scene and two scenes and maybe three scenes, and then I was like, wait a minute. Okay, I kind of understand, because I was like, I don't understand how this comes easily. I don't quite get it yet.
Me either.
But then I just hit this point where I just said, okay, it doesn't have to be totally linear, which is what we were talking about earlier in earlier episodes, and I took that to mind, and I've just kind of started on different episodes or different chapters, and that's really helped me, and
nice.
I'm excited, and I went back to an archaeology thing. Archaeology, some with horror and sci-fi.
Yeah. Ooh,
she also is an archaeologist. Lots of field work in Mesoamerica.
Yay!
Oh, cool. Very cool.
Gail has her ABD PhD in archaeology.
No, don't glorify me. Two masters.
Two masters.
Two masters.
I 2 years out from finishing the PhD when I quit.
Okay. So
no big
ABD,
deal. Just two masters. Super
just
smart.
A couple of them. One of them is an MS, of which I am very proud, because that thing was freaking brutal.
MS in what was that?
Materials analysis archaeology.
Materials analysis.
Yeah, yeah.
Nice.
Inorganics.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Okay, we might have to talk about these things. It made it easier for me to have, like, oh, I know the I know the terms, I know the things to write if I'm looking at these things, but how do I tie that into like a science fiction type of deal?
Someday. So I have two arc stories that I really want to write. Someday I want to do a coming of age, kind of like queer discovery set on an archaeological site, you know, kind of thing. But I also want to do a mystery story that's like a murder mystery, but set in a... Because I always thought, like, archaeology would be a great cozy mystery because it's like a confined... It's the perfect setting.
Yep.
I mean, yeah. You're already digging, but, like, well, was, you know, meter by meter or whatever. You can dig a six by one meter.
Agatha Christie did two archaeology mysteries, if I remember correctly. Yeah, that's a great setting. Oh, I will totally blurb those. Send those to me.
Mine has a specific twist on it, which I'm not going to talk about because so far I've never heard anybody else talk about it. So I am jealously guarding this one little secret. But, like, I don't know if I'll ever write it. Like, mystery just seems really hard to me. So I don't know. I know. Dan and I have a, like, floating challenge in the ether where someday I will write a mystery and he will write a romance.
I did just do an erotic romance
story. Not the same thing. It has to be a romance. Yes, and it has to be a romance, not an erotica.
Yeah, but I am edging closer.
So if I write anything that needs erotic or romantic scenes, can I enlist you guys? Because there's no way it would be like, hello, thank you, I like that kiss. That's great.
Yeah, they are the hardest things to write. Like, people throw other things in, and I was like, I will throw a sex scene in there as the hardest thing to write. Comedy is hard. Sex is hard. Yeah, sex is really, really
difficult. Especially keeping it interesting.
Yeah, and not cheesy and not, yeah. I'm not going too into erotica or yeah, it's really hard. Sex scenes are hard.
And even if you go hard into erotica, doing it without making it all about the plumbing is really tough.
Because
then it's just boring.
Yep. I agree. Oh, wait, we're talking about writing, right?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
No, I wasn't suggesting having sex with a plumber, though, if you're into that.
I mean, there's a whole subculture for that. So, we won't get into that.
As long as we're talking about fantasy things for Gail to write, I've always wanted you to write a cozy set in your mom's hometown.
Oh, my mom wants to do that too.
Brilliant.
We even figured out which person in the town we would be killing, who, of course, I would have to then make it not obviously that person, but it would be totally that person. Yeah. Writing a small town cozy is like totally in my oeuvre because it is one of those, Dan and I, again, we talk about this. There's like, I call it the 10% rule, but it's basically like everything you write, you're going to touch on somebody's expertise. And there's going to be about 10% of your readers who you piss off because you've like touched on their expertise and you didn't even know you were doing it or you got it wrong or whatever. And so, and I have to recognize in myself like a certain amount of 10%-itude, and it often comes to the fore with like CSI when they use instruments that I use as material analysis or what, and you know, like, and the test doesn't take 6 weeks, that kind of thing. But one of mine is small towns, as it turns out. I can tell if you, the author, are writing set in a small town and you yourself have not lived in a small town. And there's a lot of cozy mysteries and contemporary small town romances out there where I am like, oh no, small towns don't work like that.
No. Yep. Kitty, how about you? How's your writing going?
How is it going?
Good question.
I decided that I realized I was having problems with a certain aspect of my backstory, and that was how the characters all got together at the beginning of the adventure, and it didn't work for me because it required them to know each other too well, and the characters having a real deep backstory with each other just was not working for the story that I was writing, and I kept getting stuck. So last night I just rewrote the backstory, and now I'm going forward again, finally.
Is it loosened you up? You feel a lot better grip on the story?
Yeah.
Excellent.
And I have more than two characters with names now.
Woohoo!
Ah, milestone!
Nice. That's always a good thing. I have three characters that have names. I just haven't decided the names.
That can be tough.
Referring to them as Stoic and Burden. which I suppose is a little unfair.
That helps you keep track of them. Character naming is one of my least favorite things. Unless it comes to me as just a great name, I will frequently change characters' names 3 or 4 times until I find the right feel for that character.
I've done that with this one quite a bit, and then I forget what the new name is, and I get all confused with myself.
As his editor, it drives me bonkers. Like, what name?
I have been known to get hung up on the character names to such an... Character names and, like, company names or ship names to such an extent that it stalls me out of a book sometimes for a day or two. Because there comes a point where you have to have the name in order for the texture to be right, in order for the rest of the story to flow. It drives me crazy.
I like it when, most of the time, my main characters, the names are correct. Like, the names come to me relatively cool. The two main characters, if that's what I'm writing. And this one, they're very solid. The two main characters are very solid. But I came up with a naming convention for the rest of the characters that... societally a rank based.
Yeah, I have resorted to naming conventions in my big series because there's so many characters.
I'm sorry, what are naming conventions?
That's where you develop a rule set for yourself that generates the names. So
in... That sounds awesome.
All I was going to say is, like, I have different ranks of society ranks, and so the highest rank or the highest class or caste in the society, all of the first names end with the letter R. And you can shorten that name if it's multisyllabic to something else, which the characters might call each other. But if they're ever called by their full names, everybody of that rank has an R ending last name, regardless of gender or anything else.
Oh, that's interesting. Which,
that's an example. And I just gave myself that rule.
I've done that too. Some other examples, more arbitrary ones that I've used. There was a book where I gave all the bad guys names of romantic poets or authors.
That's funny, and
great literary figures. And then there was another point in the same series. I needed a cadre of dock workers to all be named, but they were going to get killed really quickly, and they were. But it was a shouty situation, so everyone had to have a name. And so I looked up at the bar. And I just gave them each names of whiskeys.
That's fun, too. I have a minor section in one of my books where there's a character who is one of 6 girls, and their mother is an assassin, and all of the girls are named after poisons.
So yes. Oh, my God, I thought it was going to be victims.
No. So there's, like, Belladonna, and so she's Bella, right? That kind of thing.
Leander.
Yeah, and the character I write is named Arsenic, and she's a doctor, just to be ironic.
It helps for me. Naming conventions come naturally to me because I was named according to one. So, like, every child in my family is named after a biblical prophet, except for one of my brothers who's named Jonathan David because he's his own best friend.
I'm struggling with names because I'm trying to go with historical accuracy. But when I look up Greek names, most of them are not secular, and it's kind of important for them to be secular right now.
There wasn't a division between the secular and the religious in the ancient world in the way we have it now.
What?
No, that's a very modern conception. The ancient world, the Romans had the patrician had class-based naming structures, and the Greeks very much named after gods and heroes most of the time, or derivatives that, if you break them down linguistically, reference a god or a hero or another thing.
All right,
like
but
that.
Major ones and not minor ones?
Both.
Oh, boy. Oh, well, I mean, I can work with that.
Yeah, but the notion of secularity is, although it exists in a different form in the Roman world, it's very much an Enlightenment phenomenon.
Mm, yeah. I don't know why I thought that would make more sense.
There are a few names in particular?
Actually, no. All the ones that I found that were historically accurate were non-secular, which, big surprise, apparently. So I didn't choose any.
Okay.
But when I looked at all the names, a lot of them had meanings attached, and I was wondering if I could just
be lazy and
look in a Greek dictionary for burden and stoic.
That's what probably, I was going to suggest do.
You actually could.
Except stoic.
Stoic is a Greek word.
Is a Greek word,
so.
Yes.
Oh, shoot. Maybe I'll go for Latin. I guess.
Or you could look at the Greek Stoic philosopher school and just pinch a name of one of the Stoic philosophers.
That's brilliant. Name them off to philosophers. Okay. Okay. Wait, that might confuse people.
How many people actually read ancient philosophers?
No idea.
But I think I'm the only one.
Me.
So. Yeah.
So, Dan, how did your writing go today?
It went really, really well. The kleptomaniac is on the march, and the captain is trying desperately to keep the crew from turning on each other, but after 17 go-overs of the ship, it's clear that they either have a thief or something else really weird is going on, so he's put everyone through a strip search and several search parties, and nothing's turning up, and so he's about to bring the whole episode to a close, and I've got the next several thefts all lined up for the next few chapters, but things are starting to get a little new. We had initial crew unity that was causing a ratings disaster, and now things are starting to come unglued a little bit because the producers are clever and evil.
And the ratings are going to go up.
The ratings are going to go up. And I've also figured out the connection that all of the characters have to each other, the reason they were all selected for this trip, because of course we all know that reality TV contestant selection is non-random. This one's just a little less non-random than usual, but they don't know their connection yet.
Great.
But one of them is starting to get an inkling about what it might be. So I'm getting all the dominoes lined up that should take me through to the murder here in about another four chapters.
That is exciting.
Mm-hmm. No, the first murder, I should say, because there will be more.
Of course there will.
How about you?
Good. I got them broken up, basically, which needed to happen, but I managed to figure out how to do it, like, with integrity to character, which makes me really happy. It's not just, like, your random miscommunication thing. They both legitimately have good reason for it, but also I got like a little tiny bit of sex of like disruptive sexy time in there, which causes trauma. So that's always fun. not super. This is clearly not high heat. These characters do not want to open the bedroom door. And I'm like, fine. Or the pod door, I suppose it would be. I'm like, fine. We won't go there with you. But they're really cute with each other. But now they're apart and the stress begins. So I'm pretty happy about it, and then I also got a confrontation with the two are cheating on their respective partners with each other, basically. And we got the first confrontation of the cheater and the partner. So now we have another confrontation to write with those. So lots of confrontations and arguments, and that's my favorite thing. People yelling at
nice.
Each other.
Your word counts will go way up in the next few days, I bet.
Yeah, I think I've gotten over one-third. I think we're rounding down to the final pass on this puppy, so I'm happy about it. I think there's a good possibility at this rate that I'll be done before the end of the month with the book, not with the word count, but with the book. But I am going to go, like, now that I've actually realized what the problem is, that the magical problem is that's keeping them apart, I need to go back, and I'm going to have to put some foreshadow in for that.
Seed it in. Well, I was hoping that I would beat you to the end of the book, but you may beat me.
Maybe.
If you're on the downslope.
It feels like it, but I could be wrong. I mean, I still have quite a bit to go. We've still got the final exams, the big illness, and then the big test, and then the big ending. So I still have quite a bit to do.
I still have a chance.
You do.
However small.
You do.
Cool. You guys want to do a question from the forums?
Sure.
Sure.
All right. So this one is again from Ed. He didn't hear the first couple episodes, and maybe some other people didn't, so did any or all of you pre-plan your project, or are you pantsing? Did the pre-planners outline, or just brainstorm in advance?
Pants on fire. Totally over here. I just totally did not have any idea before, so.
Kitty?
I outlined, and when I get stuck, I redo planning before I continue on. So, outline to hell.
Cool. How about you, Alexis?
I was inspired by a scene, a one-off scene that I wrote a few years ago, and I tried to continue it. hated it, and then made an outline and hated it a lot
more. Nice. Yeah, Gail, we know that you're completing a book that you were
It did start as a pants project, though, which is pretty unusual for me, but nothing
really?
Yeah.
You haven't done one of those in a long time.
Very long time. But nothing stays a pants project for me for very long, partly because of the way I write, and I've talked about it before, where I tend to write in, like, second or third chapter first, then I go back and write whatever the beginning parts is. Then at some point about halfway through, I'll start to write the end. And like somewhere in there, in the first third of the book, I will end up writing an outline pretty much no matter what else I do, just because I naturally default to that. And I like to know where I'm going. So this one just was a pants for a long time because I hadn't quite figured out the magical system and the way that the world works. And that is the world is the main adversary. And so it's the main driver for the plot in this book. So I needed to know that. And so one of the reasons I'm not a pantser is because I don't like how much rewriting I have to do as a pantser. So, and this book is like a poster child for that. I've had to rewrite the first third like several times. Then I end up with quality control issues between the three sections of the book. Yeah.
Yeah. So. I had started off with what was going to be my next Heinlein juvenile, but I got 400 words into that, and which is writing to a formula. I got 400 words into that and realized that it was not the book I thought it was going to be, and so I ditched it and jumped to a shelf project that was just three or four sentences of ideas. And so I've been pantsing and then having to stop and do character sheets and more outlining than I normally do because it's got an unconventional set of constraints that I'm not used to working with. So I'm using a lot more scaffolding than I normally do this time. But it's I keep it just at the end of the document, and I'm always flipping back and forth between where I'm at and the notes and the outlines and altering both on the fly, and they slowly are converging.
I have that as well. What happens then for me is I forget to check the notes, and then I write the section that I already had notes for because the story is kind of naturally... Because I've been doing this a long time, so I kind of sense where the story is going, so I'll jump ahead and write something, and then I'll forget to include that nugget, and so then I'll write the scene, and then I'll read along and encounter the nugget that I already wrote that actually pertains to a scene two scenes earlier, which is better than the scene that I just wrote, and so I have to go back and integrate the two.
Oh, I hate,
So
that's
that
what I call
happening.
The connect the dots method.
Yes, it's not great. This is not my favorite way to write a book, but then what is Nano but to experiment with weird new ways to write books?
That's right.
And the bright side is it's Nano, so I know there's light at the end of the tunnel, because come hell or high water, we'll be done at the end of November. So.
And you may be done before that, at least with the first pass.
With just the rough, yeah. But looking at this now, like I don't think I'll even allow myself to think of it as being done, because I just know already how much rewriting some of these bits are going to take. Mm-hmm. So I'll probably continue to use Nano to do that.
I've never asked you about this, but when you get into a project like this where you do have to do substantial rewriting, do you do that with your read out loud pass, or do you do that after?
No, I do it first. I do it before. Okay. So I'll do... Dan and I have talked about our methods before. As a general rule, I'm a six pass author at this juncture, which means I write a rough draft that's not considered anything in my brain at all. Then I'll clean that up on just a regular pass to a revision pass to a first draft. Then I'll usually do a second draft revision, and then I'll usually do a third draft revision, and those are all in my head. Then I go to beta readers, usually. So my audio pass isn't until the... Because for me, audio is nothing to do with, like, content or any substantial rewriting that I have to do. Audio is purely for voice. So audio, I catch redundant words and excess word use and flowery language, too much sing-song nature. It's like, I use it for that stuff. I don't use it to catch serious flaws in, like, the integrity of the plot. That's gonna come... I'm so visual, so that comes from just, like... making notes on chapters and looking at the way the chapters are laid out and stuff like that. Sometimes printing the whole thing out and rearranging it on the floor.
Oh, I've done that once. That was miserable.
Yes.
But then, yeah, when it comes to the stories, I'm much more auditory. So I get done with my rough and I pass it off to Kitty, and she goes through, because she's got a continuity brain like nobody's business. And she marks it up for continuity, and then I go through it, and as I'm going through it, I read it out loud to myself, subvocally, you know, don't really speak out loud, but the tongue's moving and everything. And doing that, I can hear the words, and that reveals to me other subtler things going on, not just the voice, but in the plot and the characterizations, so that I pick those up as I go through. And then frequently what'll happen is I'll get to the end of that pass, and it will it'll be doing final proof, and in my sleep I will realize, oh, this thing should be in the book, and it's not. And so as I'm doing the final proof, I'll stick extra bits in that I come up with in my sleep.
I think I, again, because I'm more, your audio, you're more auditory, I'm more visual, I get that by either changing the font of the document, or when I move from Scrivener to Word, because that changes the layout and the font, it changes the visual presentation on the page, and then I can catch stuff that way. Mm-hmm. So I have like two moves that I will do to do that, to that, that do that. So I will often change the font in Scrivener.
Something we were doing last year was, or something we talked about last year was changing the font to a really easy on the eye font, like almost like Comic Sans type of thing, just to free your brain,
or changing it to something that annoys you.
The editor brain.
Yeah, you change it to Courier just so it bothers you enough to be like, can I still get pulled into this story when Courier is like typewriting me in the middle of my forehead?
When I write unformatted.
Oh, interesting.
No indents, no extra space padding between paragraphs and
whatnot. Do you italicize?
I italicize, and you know, carriage returns and all that. But when I go to do the proofs, or actually when Kitty does the continuity, at that point it gets the styles applied so that it looks like a proper document. And that serves the same kind of function for me, because I interact with it differently. You know, it's the stream of consciousness while I'm writing it, and then when it's in presentation mode, that clicks a different
thing. I think I would go straight up insane if I tried to do that. I have to write in format mode. Like I have to be able to, when I go back, because I won't remember what I wrote, I'll remember the way the sentence looked on the page. When I need to go back and check something.
Yeah. Whereas I remember strings of words, like three or four words that were in that section, and so I just...
So you can do a find and replace.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I'm so jealous. I could never do that. Yeah, I have to... I visually have the shape of the section. Like, there's an action section, like, three scenes ago that I now need to fix because of this, and I'll just remember it was, like, eight strings of dialogue that were maybe six words or less, and then three long paragraphs of description, and that's where I need to edit. So I, like, literally see the shape configuration on the white space of what the sentence structure looked like. And that's when I have to go back and quick fix something. That's what I see. I could never, like, find and replace is a nightmare for me, because I can never remember exactly what words I actually wrote down in what order.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, no, I do the visual thing with poetry, but I've never done it with prose.
Huh. Interesting. Wow. Learn something new every day, right?
Indeed. Well, anybody got anything else? Questions, comments, death threats?
Not yet.
Not yet.
Let's see.
All right. See you all tomorrow, everybody.
Good night, everyone. Yeah.